Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
infrastructure today. The common law defaults, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Those of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictions vary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. You're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to Your Remedies in the Law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number in the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to Your Remedies in the Law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there, You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, so long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. And there's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time.
All right. Lastly, I want to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conference calls are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always keep it civil. Besides, if the question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it. All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
Hey, thank you so very much, Martin. I appreciate that. Tonight's speaker is Brother John. And Brother John is going to be covering a couple of subjects tonight. First, we're going to have the continuing saga of As the Stomach Churns, which is, of course, the discussion of Mr. T, his present incarceration, and direct application of him having corrected his status, and also for you to be in the witness bar watching how this entire episode continues, how it concludes. You have an inside seat to watching this litigation, and it's probably the most enviable moment that you may have for firsthand knowledge of litigation and the litigation process. The second thing that we're going to be talking about tonight is literally my favorite subject in the law, and that is probable cause. What is your probable cause? We'll go into the Fourth Amendment and deep into that, and we're also going to talk about affidavits, how affidavits are testimony, they're evidence, And the wonderful thing that I love about affidavits is when the opposition will bring forth an affidavit, the attorney will introduce an affidavit. And because it's evidence, it can be cross-examined. So I'm certain that Brother John is going to be talking about that as well. So without further ado, it's my sincere pleasure to bring forward the point of the spear and poke you with it a little bit, just for your excitement and enjoyment as well. Brother John, you there?
Thank you very much for both of you for your kind and gracious introduction, Martin and Michael. Thank you. By way of a word picture, we're going to dive into a probable cause. With Mr. T, I've had some time to review some of the evidence that they have, the video evidence that's constituted by body cams that and the dash cams that local constabulary was using. At one point, one of the local constabulary decides that they want to search Mr. T's vehicle, and Mr. T is not in it at the time. And uncontrovertible discussion on recording where they're trying to figure out a way to keep Mr. T and to arrest him. And they're figuring out what ways that they could actually arrest him when they did not have any probable cause. The only thing they had, according to them, was an anonymous witness that said there could be something wrong. But she was not clear and did not have any specifics to anything that was wrong. And so what happened was that discussing it, and it's interesting that these three constabularies are discussing their probable cause and the fact that they don't have any. And one of them is saying, look, we need to, we need to get into this vehicle. We need to check this and this, that, and, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're looking for a way around so that they the fact that they don't have any evidence so that they can get in, find some evidence, and then, quote-unquote, claim probable cause out the back door. And one of the constabulary, very, very just almost so poetically blatant, says, look, we have no probable cause to get a warrant, but if you want to go in there, we have to go get a warrant. So and he says, who's going to make the call? The guy says, nobody's making a call right now. He says, we've got to call the judge and get a warrant. You know, and we got to see if we've got enough to get a warrant. And they're cussing and discussing this. And finally, the senior constabulary on the – this was – there was a junior man, a fairly seasoned constabulary, and he's the one that objected to – the unlawful search of Mr. T's vehicle. And what happens is that they he asked the two officers, the other two constabulary, to do something. And next thing you know, on his body cam, he's inside the car, Mr. T's car, and going through his Mr. T's belongings. And finds the laptop and brings it out and calls for another constabulary. And this female constabulary starts going through the laptop. And on her body cam and the body cam of the constabulary next to her, we see her doing all kinds of searches. And she's not... exactly coloring between the lines, shall we say. And so what happens is that she's deep inside of Mr. T's laptop, and looking for anything and everything. She's doing searches, and they have no search warrant and no probable cause. And when I say no probable cause, some people would say probable cause. But let's read the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but on probable cause, supported by an oath of or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. That means there are no John Doe warrants. There's no fishing expedition warrants. They already have the evidence. They already have knowledge of the evidence. They just need to physically have it in hand. That's what the warrant is for. They know what they're looking for, or they suspect that this person took the silver dollar off the coin collector's table and put it in his pocket, and that it's not in his pocket right now, but it's in that car. So they call the judge and say, look, three witnesses saw him take the silver dollar off the coin collector's table and put it in his pocket. He got in his car. We got him three blocks later. He's out of his car. He locked the car when he got out. We need a search warrant for the silver dollar. Okay. So what's happening is that then the judge issues a warrant. Then, legally, by the Constitution, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. However, it says the unreasonable search and seizures those rights shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. It's saying that the warrant must issue because you have probable cause, and none of those searches or seizures can be done until you have the warrant. It's very, very important that you always remember the warrant. The warrant must be issued before the search and seizure. Now, we're going to jump around a little bit. There's other students that we have, and there's other cases that, and I'm going to try to refrain to just cases that I am personally familiar with, or students that we have had in the past, or maybe even current students, so that you can reasonably assume that what I'm saying has some personal kinesthetic rubber meets the road understanding of the situation. Somebody once asked the judiciary what the statute for wrongful arrest was, and the judiciary, just almost without missing a beat, says, "Oh, there isn't one." And some young lunatic in the court that was there, Amicus Curiae, that you may have some familiarity with, raised his hand. The bench recognized him and says, "Your Honor, would wrongful arrest be considered kidnapping under color of law?" And he says, "Well, I suppose." And I says, "Now, as he says, how do you apply that, young man?" And I says, "Under 18 U.S.C. 241 or 242. And he got sick in the face. He was dead stunned. He was dead sick. And the only thing he suggested was that both prosecutors dismiss the state's case immediately. And because the officers, when they arrested that young man and his wife, that was technically it was kidnapping under color of law. And at that juncture, they believed that they had been shoplifting. They thought they were certain that they had gotten from the 7-Eleven, which was only four blocks away, that they had come straight to them when the storekeeper complained, turned in their license plate and everything else. they have not been shoplifting. They did pick up two items. They looked at them, and when they explained, even after they explained to the officers, oh yeah, we did look at those. We set them down on the shelf right next to the cashier. They're right next to the cash register. They went to the store, and to the cashier's shock, they found both items sitting right next to the register, and they just decided not to buy them. In possession of exculpatory evidence, the prosecutors, both of them, did not make the judge or the jury aware of that. And they began to pursue them, not for misdemeanor shoplifting, but for grand theft shoplifting. They didn't have a definition of what was theoretically taken. And but when it came under kidnapping under color of law, and it was asked about 18 U.S.C. 241, and would the prosecutor and or possibly the bench be considered, even though they're working together, could it be considered conspiring when it's an illegal act? The case was dismissed. All three officers were allowed to leave the force to pursue other other employment opportunities quite outside of law enforcement. Not one of them ever worked in law enforcement again. And both prosecutors apparently were in possession of the knowledge made aware to them by then the storekeeper for the 7-Eleven / gas station that was there. They didn't bring it up. They wanted a conviction. These two prosecutors hadn't had a conviction in 4 months, and they were a little frustrated by their superior's complaint that it didn't look like they were doing their job because nobody had gone to jail. And which is very, very wrong, and it's a way wrong response from their superiors. Now let's move forward into another case. We'll call this Mrs. M. Mrs. M is sitting in the back of a car as a guest riding along by the driver. They have another guest, an unknown male. Well, it's a known male, but in their vehicle. The deputies that made the stop said that there was a failure to stop when entering a street. From a main street from a side street. And they say the vehicle was, I'll use the term coloring outside the lines. And what happened was that they demanded that the owner of the vehicle and his wife, who was Mrs. M in the back, get out of the vehicle. They left the other unknown male officially to them. They called him an unknown, but they knew exactly who he was, and they began to search the vehicle and, quote-unquote, found revealed a pink-in-color glass smoking device suspected for use with methamphetamine. Now, this is suspected, okay? And at this juncture, on the police report, it uses the term, your affiant observed a white, et cetera, your affiant observed this. Your affiant did notice a burnt marijuana. But there's no affidavit. There's no sworn affidavit constitutes testimony and evidence in the record. There is no affidavit to be found yet. Now, they may try to conjure up one or doctor one up. And you'd ask, well, Mrs. W., what's happening to her? Well, she was being charged with paraphernalia and a handful of other things, or Mrs. M. But Mrs. M. didn't have any of that. And usually The officers that I know that are trying to do a slam dunk and they're trying to do it right will immediately have the suspected person or the suspected criminal or the suspected felon submit to a blood test. The blood test and or a hair analysis test that will show if the potential criminal or the accused has had any sort of history of not just using the drugs, but even being in not just close proximity, but vague proximity to them with a hair test. But they didn't do any of these. None of these tests were ever, and so what happens is that we have a lot of smoke and mirrors by officers that are appeared to, for whatever reason, want to please someone at making an arrest, so they're making vague statements. But the thing that's most blatant is that based on the police report, you know, they talk about probable cause was established to show that the defendant did violate certain drug possession of drugs paraphernalia. When did they get the warrant? When did they use that probable cause to swear out an affidavit, or as it clearly states in the in Article 4, no warrant shall be issued but on probable cause supported by an oath or affirmation. When was that oath or affirmation made to the judge, either verbally, over the phone, telephonically or facially via a Zoom call or et cetera, or in paper by a written warrant? Hold on a second. My throat's drying out. Thank you for your patience. But the thing that is so blatant is that, in quote-unquote, no warrant shall issue but on probable cause, meaning that they are required to have the warrant before they do the search and seizure. Many individuals have said, well, there could be risk of it, the evidence going away or this or that, so we're kind of fudging things, and judges have gotten into accepting that. However, the Constitution, the highest law of the land, does not allow for that. And to that end, at this juncture, for that situation, the officers committed a second-degree federal felony in the fact that they did not obtain a warrant before a search and/or a seizure. And then the prosecutor is conspiring under 18 U.S.C. 241, knowing that they're a prosecutor. They know you have to have a warrant before you can do a search or seizure. They went to law school. They have law degrees, and they've been most prosecutors spent time training and mentoring underneath other prosecutors, so they all know that. And if they don't, they shouldn't be a prosecutor. But they do know it. And to that end, that means that they are choosing to overlook the highest law of the land in favor of getting a brownie point for what they consider getting a brownie point for making an arrest to please their employer, except that when it comes to pleasing their employer, we go back and we've got some major challenges there, because when it comes to pleasing your employer, we go back to the Declaration of Independence here, and it says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from who? The consent of the governed. And what happens is that it's unbelievable that they let themselves even begin to vaguely consider that when at that individual event on November 19th, 1863, when then President Abraham Lincoln wrapped up his Gettysburg Address with the sentence, "This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people," quoting the Declaration of Independence, literally. And so what happens is that we find that they're only attempting to please an interim individual of their employer, somebody down the food chain of Trump. Because in this one, the highest step on the ladder, or the highest step on the food chain, is you and I, not anybody else. The judge, that president, that senator, we're all way above them. The government is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Hold on a second. And so what happens is that these individuals, the hired help, are actually conspiring with the other hired help against their employers. And when you have that kind of activity, you appeal that activity, which I want each of you to ask yourself this question. Do you appeal that activity, or do you prosecute it? Do you file a motion against it, or do you file criminal charges or civil complaints against it? Now, it's true. If somebody makes a mistake, and it's an honest mistake, and they are trying to do the best job they can, the best way they know how, and that's all they know, then we, their employer, have a responsibility to, in the best and most respectful way, at least give them a chance to correct their behavior. You know, and usually the best way to do that is to find the correct thought-provoking questions, so all of a sudden they slap themselves on the chin and say, "Oh no, that was wrong. I got to change this." So that instead of going to legal or emotional or tactical or definitely not physical fisticuffs, but you know, legal fisticuffs with them, and you know, all of a sudden getting them to the point where they decide they want to defend themselves, which means they're never going to listen to a word we say again. But if we can ask thought-provoking questions so that the person that's coloring outside the lines realizes that they have colored outside the lines, and that we have not, and if we've been very careful not to rub their noses in it, or take them affront, or embarrass them to themselves, and certainly not in front of witnesses, you know, if we can, or a minimum of witnesses, if we can bring it up tactfully in the courtroom so that they realize that we're not attacking them, but we're being honest and sincere and asking questions of them to the point where they say, "You know what, you've got a good point. I'm wrong, you're right. Let's dismiss this case, or let's turn this around." The typical paradigm is everyone only wants to go as far as convincing either the judge or the jury that there may be some in a case that requires unanimous decision of the jury, they just want to create some vague implication of incompleteness in the prosecution, or some hint of error, so that they can get the case dismissed. But what about us, you and I, being the responsible employers that we are and that we should be, so that we go into that courtroom or that Senate Oversight Committee hearing or wherever we're at, and propound the facts as they actually are, propound the truth as it actually is, and we do it in a unimpeachable way, with an unconditional measure of respect and friendly, courteous consideration for our fellow person, to the point where those that were hammering on us with everything that they had and all their might, all of a sudden scratch their head and say, wait a minute, this lady's right, or this man is right. We need to change what we're doing. This is absolutely wrong. And see, you'd have the same event, like a Senate Oversight Committee hearing, or a hearing in a state district court or U.S. district court or a JP court. You're there for the same amount of time, but instead of walking away with just a dismissal and the charges not following you, this time, if we do it correctly and right, we walk away with a friend and an ally that may, and friends and allies, plural, that may include not just the judge, but the prosecutor and or the jury. And if we can show it in such a way that they are so impressed, they'll tell their friends the story about how liberty was restored in that one case now doesn't slowly dissipate into a pile of paperwork that is never heard again. Now other people say, oh, wait a minute, you should have heard the questions this lady or that guy asked him. And everybody, all of a sudden, when they asked him, they realized the law was wrong. And now you have not just one or two or 12 or 14 allies. Now all of them are pleading your case that you humbly propounded with honesty and integrity in that courtroom, and they're talking about it, and it begins to become the talk of the town. And if we learn how to do it right, then it spreads like wildfire. And some people say, well, Brother John, noble sentiments, that'll never happen. Yeah, right. Passing out business card sides, little printings that have 18 U.S.C. 242 on one side and on the other side, dot, dot, dot. Where in the Constitution, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it excuse my right to keep bear a firearm in that school ground, let alone your courtroom? And passing them out at the Republican State Convention back then in Austin, and then eventually in San Antonio, and then in Houston and San Antonio, and having his six-year-old son with him pass out in less than 4 hours, 13,000 of those little cards that even the then Lieutenant Governor Ken David Dewhurst asked for 2 boxes of 500 of those cards, and David Dewhurst passed them out within a week, and he called up to get more, which they weren't printed and ready yet. But by asking the right questions, you've probably heard that here in Texas, they no longer, the concealed carry laws and everything else, and the concealed carry classes and the permit to carry classes of all, I might be a firearms instructor. In fact, I might also be a chief range safety officer and with NRA credentials. Although I don't completely agree with the way the NRA does everything, but in this state, through more than 20 years, or actually it was, the big changes occurred in less than 12, individuals no longer, officers, they see a gun and they no longer ask what it is, and most of them don't even ask what it is, let alone write it up. There are still a few cases where they get written up, but at the same time, there's been a major, major change in a community that some people, there's a very, very few people, point to one or more individuals as having some significant impact on that. Now, notoriety and acclaim can be a horrible, horrible ball and chain around your ankle. Especially when it comes to the fact that the more the phone rings, the less work you get done. But if you have the chance in a courtroom to ask the correct questions, or even in a traffic stop, to ask the correct questions so that you don't leave with an adversary driving that patrol car, you leave with an ally driving that patrol car, then that traffic stop will have been a good event. It, the statements of November 19th, 1863 are very important. That tall, thin, gangly, bearded man that, at the time we called President Lincoln, committed, he wasn't quoting anything special. He was, doing anything fabulous. If you ignore the fact that he was quoting literally the Declaration of Independence, and the Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2, it's very, very simple. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they're endowed with their Creator with a certain inalienable rights. And these are inalienable, and that among these are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And when we go over to the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Okay, in Mr. T's case, it was violated very, very badly. And it says, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, those officers, they could have put something down in an affidavit or a statement of facts and signed it, saying the heretofore is signed, ascribed to, and under oath of law and under the penalty of perjury, Officer John Q. On patrol, you know, and they invaded, and because there were two other officers there, they could have witness Officer Mike, I saw it too, and Officer number witness number two, Michael three, I saw it too, you know, but they put their names on there, and then they. You know, they've got the scanners in the patrol vehicles. They can get them to the bench and get a search warrant. Judges, when they sign on for that duty, know that the phone can ring in the dark 30 in the middle of the night or early dark morning, you know. And so, you know, that's what they're there for. We need to encourage them to be able to use those rights, you know, there was a lady that, and she had a shotgun in the shotgun rack of her truck. She was in, the state of North Dakota. She drove through this little township where she did not know that the sheriff in that county frowned on women carrying guns. And it, totally, totally wrong. But she, the judge, he says, well, I'm going to, take it. It says, you have a warrant to seize that. I don't have to. I can see it. She says, and she quietly, very tactfully, read the Fourth Amendment to not the deputy sheriff. This was the sheriff. This is the sheriff himself. I'm not going to mention the county because now you know that would connect it. But she says, you know, she named the judge. She says, you know what? Here's his phone number. Call up, see if you can get a warrant. And, you know, and he says, why are you doing this? She says, I don't want to see you go to jail, Sheriff. She says, I voted for you. She had no idea what this guy was really like. And, turns out the sheriff did call the judge. Judge was instantaneously ready to give, apparently, she said the judge was ready to give instantaneously a warrant. And he says, why are you calling me so late about just a warrant for this? He says, well, this lady, I stopped her and this and that, and she explained to me this and explained to me the Fourth Amendment. Turns out that it ended up being like a 45-minute call. And the officer or the sheriff came back to her and says, you know what? I was wrong. You're right. Says, you keep your gun. And he says, you know, thank you for being patient with me. That was my niece that did that. And, she, that sheriff of that particular county, she won him over. And by the way, she didn't live in that county anymore because she had just gotten married like 8 months earlier. And at the same time, one of the things that she mentioned that the judge or had asked the sheriff was that, well, you know, you're going to have a an affidavit for me. It says, do you have that affidavit? And and he was very matter of fact and very frank. He said he hadn't prepared one and didn't. And she overheard him talking to the judge while he was sitting in seat of his car. He says I don't even know how to write an affidavit to do that. The sheriff admitted that to the judge. And when she realized that what was happening, that they were at that juncture, she was forging new ground with that sheriff. That was something that was very, very important. Now, after they've committed these illegal acts, we have to figure out a way to, as tactfully as possible, not make these guys so angry with the emotional vinegar and the when we're filing these charges against them. These charges have to be filed very coldly, very simply, unemotionally, very pragmatically, with a very constructive attitude, that we don't deviate from the respect that we would give one of our own employees, that so that when they realize that they're wrong, instead of saying, you know, walking up like somebody on a football or thing going, or when the you know, when the little guy with the black and white striped shirt at the end of the thing goes, holds up his hands, it's good. You know, we don't do that. We support them. We treat them with kindness because we don't want to walk away from that with an adversary. We want to walk away from those type of actions with an ally. And one of the biggest ways that we can restore America is by doing it with honesty and integrity. And when we have an adverse interaction with especially with constabulary or judiciary, we're going to talk about legislative issues on a separate call, but what happens is that we want to make absolute certain that we're treating them with the highest of dignity and respect, so that in their heart, if there's just the vaguest twinkle of kindness, that they realize that we are being absolutely kind to them, and that we're not their adversary. People, there's two levels that you operate with when you're looking at a two primary levels. There's many small, but there's two primary levels when you're operating with an officer, like at a traffic stop or a judge in a court case. There's always the personal level that nobody ever escapes, that no matter where you're standing, somebody else can see your body language, you know, and if you're braggadocious or boastful, they figure it out. But if you're kind and respectful, just even your body language shouts above anything that you can, you know, do at the top of your lungs. They figure it out. Then there's the pleadings and the what transpires officially on the record. Those, that's a completely different, well, some people would say it's a completely different thing. What happens is that however you slice it, whatever happens in the pleadings is all tempered by what the communication that occurs with, right out to the, not just the verbal, but out to the body language. Hang on a second. And then the third thing is that the testimony and evidence that has been entered into the record, i.e., an affidavit, is of critically prime importance. If you have testimony and evidence already on the record, and the opposing party has none, technically, the judiciary is required to rule in favor of the testimony and evidence that's on the record. If you overlook putting that on the record, oops, that's a tough punishment to take. But, you know, that's tough pills to swallow. But the pill that we have to swallow is the fact that we did not give the judge any testimony and evidence to work with. So he has to rule in favor of whatever other testimony and evidence, no matter how emotional you are or whatever. Please, please, please consider unequivocally putting your testimony into, entering it into the record as evidence through an affidavit. Okay? Don't assume anything. Don't stretch whatever you're, hang on a second. I'm sorry, my throat's kind of parched. I was on a long dry fast for the last 24 hours. I had surgery today and was not allowed to drink anything for the 24 hours previous to the surgery. So I'm still kind of recovering a little bit. But when you have testimony and evidence on the record and they don't, some judges, some judiciary are tempted to overlook that. And what you'll need to do is, Your Honor, in the absence of any testimony or evidence in controversy to the facts that we have already propounded in evidence, we respectfully request that the court rule in our behalf. And you know what? You'll find yourself 4 out of 5 times having to ask for that. But when you ask for that, that's when the judge is empowered to do something in your behalf. Now, if they have testimony and evidence on the record, and you don't, and you realize you don't, you should have, how do you deal with that? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. And remember when Michael was making his introduction, he talked about the evidence, and that the moment the affidavit is on file, now it's subject to cross-examination. Your Honor, that's true. I saw that affidavit as well. And had that be all the testimony or evidence that I had, Your Honor, I'd want to rule just the way you are. However, at this time, I'm going to have to object because of this point, and this point. And we'd like to call that affiant to the stand now and confirm those statements. And they say, well, we've only got the affidavit, Your Honor. I have the right to cross-examine all witnesses against me. And for those of you who are saying, oh, yeah, I already hear you. You know, you're already talking about the Sixth Amendment. And in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public. Remember that word public, because this Zoom conference thing where nobody else admitted is illegal and unconstitutional. But to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury in the state and district where the crime might have been committed, and the district where shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed the nature of the cause of the accusation, to be confronted with witnesses against him, and have the compulsory process of obtaining witnesses in his favor, and the assistance of counsel for his defense. Okay, you have the right to cross-examine any witness against you. The thing that's very, very important is that if the affiant is not available, then the affiant's testimony, unless there are extenuating circumstances like the affiant is dead, in some cases the judge will consider the affiant's testimony, but you have the right to cross-examine all of the witnesses to confront all the witnesses against him. And that means including the ones that signed the affidavit, the affiants. So what happens is that, Your Honor, I'd like a subpoena issued for this affiant. And the prosecution gets up and says, object, Your Honor, object, object, object. This is a confidential informant. This is a confidential witness. Your Honor, I have the right to confront and be confronted with any and all witnesses against me. If this witness is not available. I understand there's an affidavit on file or entered into the record, testimony evidence entered into the record. In the absence of being able to cross-examine this witness, this affiant, I move that all of that witness's, that affiant's testimony and evidence be stricken from the record. So what happens is that there is a way to deal with it. Make certain that when you make an affidavit, that you are there to support it. Your affiants, if you have somebody else sign it, that they're eventually that will be there to support it. We had a case that was ruled on today in Nebraska that I got an email that they said they went to the affidavit of a witness to Exhibit A, page 72, pulled out this information, and this is how they ruled. This is how they got the ruling. And that was I got that email just about 8 hours ago, or 10 hours ago. It was right before I went into surgery. I got a call, a text, and an email. Affidavits. Affidavit equals testimony and evidence on the record. Probable cause is probable cause to get a warrant. It's not in place of a warrant and does not absolutely supersede a warrant. Probable cause with an affidavit that constitutes testimony and evidence on the record is what's necessary to get a warrant. Then the search and or seizure can continue. My time has now come to a close. Thank you all for your patience and your graciousness. The question and answer time is now will now commence. If you would like to stay with the subject matter topic, that provides greater continuity and capacity for others to help understand the topic. However, you are not required to during the Q&A to refrain to the subject matter topic. With that, back to you, Michael and Martin, sir.
Well, John, one of the things I'd like to emphasize, and you just touched on it at the very, very end, when you talked about the fact that the probable cause was not the justification to to go into your car or do whatever. I love the way you expressed it several weeks ago when you talked about it, and that the person being falsely accused or temporarily, having been arrested, because if you're not free to leave, you're arrested. It doesn't matter whether they formally tell you that or not. If you're not free to leave, you're arrested. But I loved your response when the person would say to the officer, "What is your probable cause?" And he goes, "Well, I have probable cause." And then the person that was being arrested said, "Hey, that's great. I'll sit here and just wait until you get your you send your probable cause to a judge and get them to sign off on it. I'll sit here and wait. Doesn't matter." Something like that effect. I just really like the way you said it.
Actually, the way I said it was, officer, what is your probable cause for the search? Because that one individual, when he stepped out of the car, he locked the car with the keys inside clearly on the dash. It was a Ford and it had that, tin code thing to open it, but the officer was, open the door now. He says, "Well, what is your probable cause?" I've got probable cause. I says, "You know what? Then I tell you what. I'm happy to wait here until you take that probable cause and you go to the judge and you get the warrant." At that one event, it was so good. He said, he said, "Well, why do I have," he says, "pull out your phone." He got the Fourth Amendment there and he read it. And, he ended up not getting a warrant for that one event there. But yeah, you know what? I'm happy to wait right here while you, call the judge right now and take your probable cause and get your warrant. You still there?
Yeah, we're here.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Yes, sir. I I thought I was hearing crickets there for a moment.
Well, you know I mute myself whenever you start
talking. Yeah. Okay. Back to you, Martin and Michael.
All right. Star 2 on your keypad, folks, if you have a question. That's for everybody on the call. Star 2 at this time to raise your hand. If you're listening on the Freedoms Radio side, type your questions in the question bar at this time and click submit.
By the way, if you always drain a stop, as Michael pointed out earlier, says, you know, I'm happy to wait for you to, take your probable cause to the judge. And if I need to wait here a couple hours, I'd be happy to do so. If you make a statement like that to constabulary, most of them, you will shock the stuffing out of them. And what will happen is that you'll find out that you'll change the way they respond in a positive manner 9 out of 10 times. So and someday if any of you ever get to meet my son, he'll tell you we got stopped just a couple weeks ago at a flickering taillight. And I says, Your Honor, or Your Officer, I'm honored to and pleased to accept whatever ticket you choose to write me. Again, I'm not writing. Back to you, Martin and Michael.
All right. Get a refresh here. I haven't seen any questions pop up just yet.
Well, if there are no questions, I have to admit, I only got out of surgery at just after 5 o'clock this afternoon, and I got rushed home to do this conference call. And if everybody else is amenable to letting Brother John get off early tonight with a little bit of hopefully good behavior, that would be a blessing to me. So, save your... pack up your questions and save them for next week. The ones that come during the week, it'll be my honor and privilege to do what I can for you.
John, I want to remind you, you had given me a heads up for next week, the 19th, that you most likely will not be here.
Oh, that's right. Okay, my humble apologies. Michael is correct. My father just passed away. His viewing is Tuesday night or Tuesday afternoon, starts at about 4 o'clock Pacific time and goes to 9 o'clock Pacific time, which may actually give me enough time that I might get done. The funeral's a week from tomorrow, and the viewing would be just wrapping up about now. If I can't make it, I apologize, and then I'll see you in 2 weeks. It is my intention to try and make the call. It is truly an honor and privilege to serve beside all of you at the labor of restoring liberty to America. And with that, I'll bid you all good evening. Back to you, Martin.
We do have one pop-up real quick. Kent in West Virginia, go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, good evening, Kent.
Yes, good evening. We're not going to let you off that easy, John. You have to at least... take one question. So, first of all, my condolences to you and your family regarding your father.
Thank you for your kind words and your warm thoughts, Kent. Appreciate you very much, brother.
Did you have
anything else?
Yes, I had a question that I want to ask you. You have used the example numerous times when you do these calls. You have used the example. Where does it say, Your Honor? Where does it say that I can't bring a gun into the courtroom? Words to that effect. What I wanted to ask you is, where do they believe that they derive any authority to make executive orders, mandates, you know, rules and regulations, et cetera. Would you put that under the same category, or if there was a question that came up about a mandate, let's say something about, to use a current topic, a mask, which may be coming up again, would you use the same type of question with that, or would you formulate a different question if it was allegedly under an executive order or a mandate? I don't know if that question makes a lot of sense to you, but, you know, it's something that I think about.
Do you know where executive orders and mandates, the etymology of them?
Were they what?
Do you know where the term executive order, the etymology of that?
No, I do not.
It comes from the Emergency War Powers Act of 1933. And what happens is that the Emergency War Powers Act gives the president unilateral authority by Congress in situations in time of war where that might require normal congressional approval, but there, because of the imminency of a situation or broader domestically that may involve war, they let the president, the Congress agreed in the Emergency War Powers Act of 1933 to allow the president to make those decisions without congressional oversight. Now, to be able to enact the Emergency War Powers Act, it requires a state of war, and whether you realize it or not, every single president, the day they have stepped in office, has for some one reason or another affirmed or reaffirmed the fact that America is at war in the process of keeping the status of the Emergency War Powers Act of 1933 active.
Okay, so let me add something there. But where did Congress derive the power or the right to delegate what was given to them as their authority to a third party or to another branch of government?
Well, it's always been believed that a man can convey his authority unless it's otherwise stated that he cannot. And at this juncture, what happens is we find ourselves right after the First World War got over in 1918, we realized that there were many issues regarding the war that had not been properly addressed because Congress did not have the capacity to convene quickly enough, and along with the some other atrocities, things that occurred, legislation that occurred in 1933, and many of you may remember that that's also the year that we declared bankruptcy, and that was 1932 was the last year that there was a validly constituted, duly elected senator or elector, and that they left office in 1938. But what happened was that technically they could do that. It was in the effort to improve the response during wartime. That was officially that was the story on top, Kent. The story that actually underlies was that there were some money people that needed a little bit better response time for certain activities so that these families could capitalize as best they could or would. And so while it was done technically, legally, the people that pulled the puppet strings, I mean the people that supported the elected officials may have had a personal interest in the lobbyist and why it was done.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, yeah,
all right,
sense.
John. That's great. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. We want to let John get some rest. He he needs it. And we'll bring this question up again for further delving, possibly next week or the week after. Is that all right with you, Kent?
I guess so. I did have one thing I wanted to add to that.
Yeah, well, next week, please. Please write it down so you don't forget. We want to cover it.
Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you, Kent. The Father's blessing be upon you, brother. Love you dearly. And to all the rest of you, once again, I'll iterate, it is an honor and a privilege to serve beside you in restoring liberty to America. Thank you. In a roll call vote, it's my honor to be called number 57 beside all of you. Good night. Martin's got the rest of the announcements.
Yep, absolutely. We'll see everybody back here again tomorrow night, same time, same place. We'll be having our normal Wednesday call with Eric Slevin, discussing LLC, and then we'll be back again Thursday with our normal recorded calls for the home foreclosures. Until next time, everybody have a wonderful evening and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.